Model Test 5, Listening Section.
The listening section tests your ability to understand spoken English that is typical of interactions and academic speech on college campuses. During the test, you will respond to conversations and lectures. This is the long format for the listening section. On the long format, you will respond to 3 conversations and 6 lectures. After each listening passage, you will answer 5 to 6 questions about it. Only 2 conversations and 4 lectures will be graded. The other conversation and lectures are part of an experimental section for future tests. Because you will not know which conversations and lectures will be graded, you must try to do your best on all of them. You will hear each conversation or lecture 1 time. You may take notes while you listen, but notes are not graded. You may use your notes to answer the questions. Choose the best answer for multiple choice questions. Follow the directions on the page or on the screen for computer-assisted questions. Click on Next and OK to go to the next question. You cannot return to previous questions. You have 25 to 30 minutes to answer all of the questions. A clock on the screen will show you how much time you have to complete your answers for the section. The clock does not count the time you are listening to the conversations and lectures.
Listening 1, Professor's Office.
Listen to part of a conversation between a student and a professor.
Professor Collins, I'm really sorry. I mean, these are my daughters. They're twins. I wouldn't ordinarily bring them to an appointment, but the babysitter didn't show up and I couldn't leave them. I didn't want to cancel. I hope it's okay.
It's okay. I have 3 kids of my own, and I've been in the same situation.
Thanks. Well, this shouldn't take much of your time. I really just have 1 question.
All right.
I'm having a problem understanding the difference between declarative memory and procedural memory. I think from my notes that they're both examples of... Let me see. I have it down here. Declarative and procedural memory are 2 broad types of memory circuits in long-term memory.
That's right, but you need to distinguish between them.
Exactly.
Okay, well, declarative memory is a memory that links us to a fact, like a name or a date or even an experience.
So when I remember a professor's name, when I see him, that's declarative memory?
Yes, at its most basic level, it is. But declarative memory also includes problem solving. Like today, when you decided to bring your daughters to my office, you were using declarative memory to access previous experiences and facts that would allow you to make a decision.
Oh, right. I remember your example in class. That makes sense now. You were talking about problem solving by recalling experiences, but wasn't that episodic memory?
Very good. Yes, it's called episodic memory. But declarative memory includes episodic memory, which is the ability to access prior experiences or personal episodes in our life, usually for the purpose of making a decision or solving a problem. So episodic memory is a subcategory of declarative memory, so to speak. And semantic memory is just the storehouse of facts that we have in our memory circuits.
Which is also a subcategory of declarative memory?
Precisely.
Okay. Then procedural memory doesn't include facts or experiences.
Not directly, no. Procedural memory refers to skills that we've learned and are now remembering in order to perform the skill without really thinking much about it. Like, for example, riding a bike or do you play a musical instrument?
Piano, sort of. Not really.
Okay. Well, when you ride a bike then, you aren't thinking about the name of every part of the bike and how to use the handlebars or the pedals, or at least not consciously.
No.
But at some level, you are remembering how to do these things, so you're using your memory.
And that'd be procedural memory.
Yes, it would.
Okay, then. That's why you said that declarative memory can be more rapidly learned, but it can also be more rapidly forgotten. Because a fact can come and go in the memory. But procedural memory takes repetition and practice, so it's harder to unlearn. I'm not saying that very well.
But you have the idea. Often with declarative memory, you're consciously trying to remember. But with procedural memory, you're performing a skill without consciously trying to recall how, without each step in the process.
That's what I mean. But
Yes?
Well, I was thinking about language when my girls were learning to talk.
Oh, I see where you're going. You want to know whether language learning is declarative or procedural.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I was thinking that maybe it's both, because you have to memorize vocabulary, but eventually it's more like a skill, like riding a bike, because you don't think about each individual word. It's more automatic. Do you see what I mean?
A very good analysis. I think you've got this.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
And if you ever need to ask me a question and it's hard to get in to see me, just drop me an email.
I thought about that, but...
Look, I'm always glad to see you, but I answer a lot of questions like this by email every day. And if it's easier for you, that's fine with me.
That's very kind of you. Thank you so much.
1. Why does the woman go to see her professor? 2. What do semantic memory and episodic memory have in common? 3. When the professor gives the example of riding a bicycle, what kind of memory is he referring to? 4. Listen again to part of the conversation, and then answer the following question.
Do you see what I mean?
A very good analysis. I think you've got this.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
What does the student mean when she says this?
Do you see what I mean?
Five. What does the professor suggest?
2. Literature class.
Listen to part of a discussion in a literature class.
Today, we're continuing our discussion of Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. We left off last session at the point where Gulliver began his fourth voyage as the captain of a merchant ship. As you'll recall, his crew had confined him and cast him ashore on an island. While making his way along a road, he was attacked by a herd of deformed beasts with brown skin and no tails. But suddenly, the attack was interrupted by the appearance of a beautiful horse. And this is where we left off. So what happens next?
Well, another horse comes along, and they appear to be having a conversation. The two horses, I mean. And they keep using the words Yahoo and Whininum. So Gulliver is able to understand that Yahoo refers to the animals that attacked him, and Whininum refers to the horses. Then Gulliver goes home with the horses.
And what is Gulliver thinking about while he's observing the Yahoos and the Whininums?
Oh, this was good. He starts to understand that the only difference between himself and the Yahoos is his clothing. But he's horrified by this. So we see him trying to be more like the horses.
How do you know that he's striving to emulate the Whininums?
Well, he learns their language so he can communicate with them.
Right. So this brings us to the most important part of the narrative, the comparison between the Yahoos and the Whininums. First, tell us how the Yahoos are portrayed. What do they eat? How do they look?
Well, I think the author used the word depraved several times. They eat dog and donkey meat and even garbage, and they drink too much. And he says they're filthy and they stink.
So their behavior, the Yahoo's behavior, is neither rational nor moral. Now, take a look at the description of the Yahoos that Gulliver has known in England. Let me refer to the book here. Okay, Gulliver explains that Yahoos in England fight wars for religious reasons, that lawyers use reason to argue for the wrong side, that the wealthy live to acquire more luxuries, and that greed makes them ill. By this we assume that he's referring to the rich gourmet diet that causes gout and other health problems among the upper classes. So this is in contrast with the Houyhnhnms, right? How so?
Yes. Well, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that they eat oats, bread, and honey, but not meat, not other animals, and they don't drink.
I think it's important that they don't even understand the concept of a lie. That proves that they have a very innocent nature.
Good point. You're referring to the fact that they failed to grasp how the crew was able to initiate the mutiny that brought Gulliver to their island.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what do the Houyhnhnms think about Gulliver? And what does Gulliver conclude about himself?
Well, Gulliver isn't really a Yahoo, and he isn't really a Houyhnhnm either. I'd say he's kind of in the middle, but he's trying to become a Houyhnhnm. When he goes back to England, he's actually afraid of other humans. I mean, Yahoos.
But he can't quite achieve his transformation, can he? Even though his pride motivates him to continue the impossible pursuit of perfection. So what does this all mean?
I think it's like the other chapters. The fourth voyage it's another critique of the weaknesses in human nature.
Then Swift's making the point that although humankind is capable of rational behavior, we seldom choose to exercise it. The very meaning of the word Yahoo in the Houyhnhnm language is evil. So Swift's very satirical then. And when we consider the time period for the book, the early 1700s, we must appreciate the exceptional departure from the literature of the era, which was mostly written to flatter or entertain. Swift used satire to provide the reader with a perspective that's very different from that of other writers in an age of science and reason.
6. What is the discussion mainly about? Seven. What does Gulliver learn about himself? Eight. In the discussion, the professor describes the characteristics of the Yahoos. Indicate whether each of the following is one of their characteristics. Click in the correct box for each sentence. Nine. Listen again to part of the discussion and then answer the following question.
But he can't quite achieve his transformation, can he? Even though his pride motivates him to continue the impossible pursuit of perfection. So what does this all mean?
Why does the professor say this?
So what does this all mean?
Ten. According to the professor, what kind of book is Gulliver's Travels? Eleven. What can we infer about the literature of the period?
Listening 3, Geology Class.
Listen to part of a discussion in a geology class.
The exploitation of minerals involves 5 steps. First, you have to explore and locate the mineral deposits. Then you set up a mining operation. Next, you must refine the raw minerals and transport the refined minerals to the manufacturer.
Excuse me, sorry, I only have 4 steps. Could you...
Oh, sure. That's exploration, mining, refining, transportation, and manufacturing.
Thanks.
So, each of these activities involves costs. There are costs associated with them, and the costs can be economic, but not necessarily so. Mineral exploitation also has environmental costs associated with it. For example, the exploration stage will clearly have a high economic cost because of personnel and technology, but the environmental cost will probably be quite low. Now, why would that be, do you think?
Because you aren't actually disturbing the environment, you're just looking. I mean, after you find a mineral deposit, you don't do anything about it at that stage.
Right, so the environmental cost would be low. But what happens when you use up all the resources that are easy to find? Then what?
Then the costs go up for exploration.
Which costs?
Well, probably both of them. But I can see where the economic costs would increase.
Okay. Let's say, for example, that some areas such as national parks or historic reserves have been off limits to exploration. What'll happen when we use up the minerals outside of these areas? Remember now that these are non-renewable resources that we're looking for.
Then there'll be a lot of pressure, you know, to open up these areas to exploration and exploitation.
Probably so. And that means that there could be a high environmental cost. Any other options?
Find an alternative.
Yes, you're on the right track.
Okay, find an alternative. I mean, a substitute, something that'll substitute for the mineral. Maybe something man-made?
Good. That'll involve a different kind of exploration. Again, with economic costs. I'm talking about basic research here to find synthetics. But let's go on to the other steps and we'll see if we can pull this all together. How about mining? Now, we're looking at high environmental costs because of the destruction of the landscape and the accumulation of waste products that have to be dealt with. Air and water pollution is almost always a problem. Any ideas on refining?
Wouldn't it be the same as mining? I mean, you'd have high costs because of labor and equipment, and there'd be problems of waste and pollution, like you said.
True, true. And in refining, well, that often involves the separation of a small amount of a valuable mineral from a large amount of surrounding rock. So that means that refining also carries the additional cost of cleanup. And don't forget that it's often difficult to get vegetation to grow on piles of waste. In fact, some of it, the waste piles, I mean, they can even be dangerous to living creatures, including people, not to mention the appearance of the area. So the environmental cost can be extremely high. Isn't it sad and ironic that so much of the mining and refining must take place in areas of great natural beauty?
So you're saying that both mining and refining have heavy costs, heavy economic and environmental costs?
Right. And in both mining and refining, you'd need transportation to support the movement of supplies, equipment, and personnel. But after the minerals are mined and refined, then transportation becomes even more essential.
And I was just thinking that in addition to the economic costs of the transportation for trucks and fuel and labor and everything, there might be some construction too, if there aren't any roads in or out of the area.
And that would mean?
That would mean that the landscape and even the ecosystem for the plants and animal life could be altered. So that's an environmental cost.
It is indeed. Good point. That leaves us with manufacturing. After we find it, mine it, refine it, and transport it, we still have to manufacture it. What are the costs associated with that? Well, construction again for factories. Then there'd be energy costs, technology, and labor.
So all that's economic. No environmental costs in manufacturing then?
Well, yes, there are actually. Pollution's often a costly problem for manufacturing plants.
Oh, right. I was thinking of the natural landscape, and the manufacturing is often positioned near cities to take advantage of the labor pool. But cities have the environmental problems associated with pollution. So every step has both economic and environmental costs then.
Right.
12. What is this discussion mainly about? Thirteen. According to the professor, what are two problems that can be anticipated when roads are cut into an area for mining? Fourteen. Listen again to part of the discussion and then answer the following question.
And I was just thinking that in addition to the economic costs of the transportation for trucks and fuel and labor and everything, there might be some construction too, if there aren't any roads in or out of the area.
And that would mean?
Why does the professor say this?
And that would mean...
Fifteen. What option is proposed as an alternative when all of the mineral resources in easily accessible locations have been depleted? Sixteen. What does the professor imply about the environmental costs of mineral exploitation? 17. What does the professor want the students to do in this class session?
4. Professor's office.
Listen to part of a conversation on campus between a student and a professor.
Hi, I'm Ron Watson. I'm here to apply for the work-study job.
Oh, good. Have you ever had a work-study position?
Not really. To tell the truth, I'm not exactly sure how it works.
Well, it's like this. On work-study, you have regular hours and assigned responsibilities. But if you get everything done, you can study. You can't leave because there may be something else to do later during your hours. But you should always bring your books and... Oh, I guess that probably about 25% of the time you should be able to study.
This is even better than I thought. What kind of assignments would I have? I mean, if I get this opportunity.
Clerical, mostly, I'm afraid. Nothing too demanding. But it isn't the most interesting work, either. Filing, copying, delivering mail, some grading. But only multiple choice tests. And we use a grading machine for that.
Would someone show me how to operate the grading machine? I'm sure I could do it if someone showed me once or twice.
No problem. We have a secretary here in the department, and she'll be the main person you'd report to. She'd show you how to do everything.
Okay, great.
Now, let's see whether your hours will fit in with the hours we need. Could you work Monday through Thursday from 10 to 2?
That's 16 hours a week?
To start. We may actually want to extend that to Fridays, so if that happens, it'd be 20 hours. You'll notice that the hours include the usual lunch break. That'd let Nancy, she's the secretary, so she could get you started on the work, and then take her lunch from noon to 1 and be back for the last hour of your day, in case you had any questions.
Okay.
Oh, and I should tell you about the phone. While Nancy's gone for lunch, we'll want you to answer the phone.
Sure, I can do that. Will there be any work on the computer? I'm familiar with most of the basic office programs. I used to help my dad in his office when I was in high school. He's a lawyer.
Oh. Well, we hadn't planned to include anything like that in the job, but it's a plus.
Sorry to ask, but how does the pay work? Do I get paid for the time I work minus the study time, or...
Oh, no. You get paid for 16 hours a week whether you're working or studying. This is a special program for students.
It seems too good to be true.
Well, you need to have an interview with Nancy. Since you'll be working closely with her, she'll make the final decision.
Okay. Should I make an appointment or...
No. Just go over to her desk and tell her who you are. She's expecting you. We want to get the position filled as soon as possible.
Well, thank you for seeing me. I hope I'll be working here.
Good luck. Oh, yes. Be sure to tell Nancy about the computer experience.
I will.
And let her know I've already interviewed you and I referred you to her.
Thanks again. I really appreciate your taking the time to explain everything to me.
You're welcome.
18. Why does the student go to the professor's office? 19. Listen again to part of the conversation and then answer the following question.
What kind of assignments would I have? I mean, if I get this opportunity.
Clerical, mostly, I'm afraid. Nothing too demanding, but it isn't the most interesting work either.
What does the professor mean when she says this?
Clerical, mostly, I'm afraid.
What experience does the man have that may be helpful? 21. What is the pay for the work-study position? 22. What can we assume about the meeting?
5. Music Appreciation Class.
Listen to part of a lecture in a music appreciation class.
As you know, tonight's the concert that I want you to attend, so I'll keep the class short today. Let me tell you a little bit about the history of chamber music, so you'll be prepared to appreciate the music that you hear tonight. The University Quartet's one of the best in the region, so you'll be hearing an excellent example. Anyway, about chamber music. From medieval times through the 18th century, musicians in Europe had basically two options for employment, the church or the nobility. So when they weren't creating pieces for religious occasions and performing at church functions, musicians were playing in the chambers of stately homes. Now, a chamber is the name for a room where guests may be assembled, kind of like a hall. And because of their association with this room, this chamber, the musicians who played for the wealthy patrons came to be known as chamber players. Chamber music's written to be performed by a relatively small group, more than one, but fewer than a dozen musicians. I should tell you that pieces for more than eight players are unusual, though, and it's very rare to see a conductor. It may surprise you to know that any combination of instruments can be used for chamber music. The strings, woodwinds, and piano are so often associated with chamber music, and they remain the most popular, even today. But chamber music has been written for other instruments as well. Well, the history of chamber music is usually divided into three distinct periods. In the classical period, and that extends from the mid-1700s to around 1820, so in the classical period, chamber music, like many other expressions of the arts, it reacted to the extravagant Baroque style by creating new structures, and these structures expressed simplicity, balance, and order. It was the age of the Enlightenment, with the ideals of logic and reason. So this translated into compositions with one melodic line. The melody, it was usually written for the violin, and all other instruments provided an accompaniment. Early chamber music in the classical tradition often included the recorder, the harpsichord, and the viola. Vienna was a hub of activity for chamber music, and three composers dominated the artistic scene. Franz Joseph Haydn's generally credited with organizing the string quartet, and he produced more than 80 pieces for it, the quartet. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart also composed chamber music, including not only quartets but also quintets, and trios with clarinet and even piano sonatas. Since the music was relatively simple, many amateurs played for their own enjoyment. This was new, but by then music was being printed and more people had access to it. So music rooms became popular and people played chamber music as a social activity. Well, it was Ludwig von Beethoven who probably bridged between the classical period and the romantic period. And I say that because his works were longer and perhaps more complex than his predecessors. And I find this amazing since the later quartets were all created when he was totally deaf. In any case, composers and performers were beginning to break free of the formal confines of the classical period. Their works became increasingly more difficult, expressing some of the high emotions of the 19th century, which, as you will recall, the backdrop of that century. The French and the American revolutions, they were defining moments. So Chopin, Liszt, and Wagner wrote very little chamber music because they preferred the emotional power of the full orchestra or the personal expression in a piano solo. It was also at about this time that Franz Schubert, Johannes Brahms, Felix Mendelssohn, and Antonin Dvorak made their contributions, and they wrote melodic, passionate compositions for chamber players. But now the music was more difficult to play, and the patronage system was declining anyway, so So most chamber music moved from the great homes of the wealthy and into the concert halls, which were frequented by a growing middle class. And it was a very creative period for chamber music, and professional chamber groups merged during this time. The composers probably felt a new freedom because they weren't so much pressed to please their patrons and they could explore their art. Well, at the turn of the century, the modern period ushered in an opportunity for even greater experimentation. Painters were bringing Impressionism to the forefront of the artistic consciousness, and this was reflected musically in the work of Claude Debussy and Maurice Ravel. Their chamber music was considered revolutionary. Debussy and Ravel, because unlike previous composers, their compositions had recurring themes instead of a continuous melody. And there are a number of other composers who wrote chamber music in the modern period, but whether they'll be remembered is, well, a question to be answered by future historians. What we do know is that the modernists gave chamber music new combinations of instruments and arrangements. And as the music became more unexpected, often with unusual tonality, well, it also became even more difficult to play, and that meant that the scores for modern chamber music had to be played by very skilled ensemble musicians. This evening at the concert, the University Quartet will perform one of the classical pieces by Haydn. You'll hear the quartet in D minor, opus 76, number 2, third movement. There are two violins, one cello, and one viola. So, that said, I'll see you tonight.
23. What is the main purpose of the lecture? 24. What is the origin of the term chamber music? 25. Which of the following are the key characteristics of chamber music in the classical period? 26. Listen again to part of the lecture and then answer the following question.
Well, it was Ludwig von Beethoven who probably bridged between the classical period and the Romantic period. And I say that because his works were longer and perhaps more complex than his predecessors. And I find this amazing since the later quartets were all created when he was totally deaf.
What does the professor mean when she says this about Beethoven?
And I find this amazing since the later quartets were all created when he was totally deaf.
27. Why does the professor mention Impressionism? 28. How did the professor organize the lecture?
6. Botany class.
Listen to part of a discussion in a botany class. The professor is talking about hydroponics.
Although the recent interest in hydroponics may lead you to believe that it's a relatively new idea, the process probably originated in ancient times. In fact, the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon may well have been one of the first successful attempts to grow plants in water, that is, hydroponically. Early agriculture in Pakistan and India, as well as other areas throughout the Middle East, included water crops. And we also have evidence that the Egyptians were growing plants in water along the Nile. And that was without soil. Asia and the South Pacific were prime locations for early hydroponic gardens. And in the Western Hemisphere, we know that the Aztecs had developed an advanced system of water agriculture along the marshlands of Lake Tenochtitlan in the Central Valley of Mexico, because when the Spanish arrived, they made drawings in their journals of floating islands of trees and vegetation. In other words, hydroponic agriculture. Okay, well, this isn't a history class. It's a botany class, but I think it's important when we're talking about scientific discoveries that we understand how science works. Sometimes we're rediscovering and refining methods that have been used for a very long time, and that's certainly the case of hydroponics. Through the years, it's been called nutriculture, chemiculture, aquaculture, soilless culture, but the current term is hydroponics. And that encompasses the modern science of growing plants without soil by using an inert medium, such as sand, peat, gravel, or even sawdust or styrofoam. Of course, you have to add a solution of nutrients. Clearly, good soil has the nutrients necessary for plant growth. But when plants are grown without soil, all the nutrients must be provided in another way. So, why do you think that we'd go to all of this additional effort to replace soil?
Well, I think the book mentioned something about keeping the growing medium more sterile.
Uh-huh. Soil-borne diseases and pests and even weeds can be virtually eliminated by using a soil alternative.
So I was thinking probably you wouldn't require as much labor to get rid of the pests and weeds.
Good thought. Now tell me what you know about fertilizer and water.
Oh, right. Less fertilizer and water are required per plant since they're constantly reused. And aren't the results more uniform because of the highly controlled conditions?
Right on both counts. But probably the most important advantage is the ability to cultivate a larger number of plants in a limited space. Where would this be important, do you think?
Well, small or isolated environments or very arid climates with limited freshwater supplies, probably.
Or regions with poor soils, for instance, in developing countries where the weather conditions aren't dependable and famine could happen.
Or the area may have a dense population.
So hydroponics is limited to developing regions, then?
I'm not sure about that. Even in highly industrialized nations, populations are growing, and isn't the total acreage and cultivation dropping to accommodate the expansion of urban areas?
Well stated. As agricultural land is sold for development, hydroponics has become a viable option for almost every country in the world. Now, earlier, I said that we're often rediscovering ancient methods in science, but we're also adapting them by using improvements from other scientific research. In the case of hydroponics, there are probably two modern discoveries that have supported progress in hydroponics. Okay, first, the development of plastics that allowed growers to abandon the old concrete beds, which were costly to construct and problematic because they leached into the nutrient solution. But plastic beds are cheap, they're light and sterile, an ideal replacement for concrete. And many of the greenhouses themselves are even built of plastic panels. Okay, the other important advancements, the knowledge we've accumulated about plant nutrition. Of course, like I said, good soil has the nutrients necessary for plant growth. But when plants are grown without soil, all the nutrients must be provided in another way. And now we have a much better idea of what we need to use in the solution to obtain the best results. So, all of that said, let's talk about the lab experiment that we set up here. This solution contains potassium nitrate, ammonium sulfate, magnesium sulfate, monocalcium phosphate, and calcium sulfate. Don't try to write down all of that now. You can refer to your lab workbook for the list of substances and the proportions needed for proper plant growth. For now, just look at this diagram. The drawing in your lab workbook should look more or less like this one. As you know, for plants grown in soil, the roots absorb water and nutrients, but they also serve to anchor the plant. That's why the roots of our hydroponic plants aren't placed directly in the water and nutrient solution. We used sterile gravel, held in place by wire mesh, to anchor the plants, and that allowed us to suspend the roots in the tank below. Remember, the tank contains the water and nutrient solution. So, because oxygen's also taken in by the roots, we had to attach an air pump to mix oxygen into the solution. Remember, a constant source of oxygen is one of the major problems with hydroponics tanks of this kind. And you can see the way that the pump was attached to the tank. Okay, it's almost time for our break this morning, so I'd like you to come over to the hydroponics area and examine the experiment close up. I'd also like you to take a closer look at this specimen of nutrient solution. What do you notice about this? Can you draw any conclusions? Today's day one for you to record your observations on the chart in your workbook.
29. What is this discussion mainly about? 30. Why does the professor talk about the history of hydroponics? 31. According to the professor, what is the greatest advantage of hydroponics? 32. Listen again to part of the discussion and then answer the following question.
Or regions with poor soils, for instance, in developing countries where the weather conditions aren't dependable and famine could happen.
Or the area may have a dense population.
So hydroponics is limited to developing regions, then?
I'm not sure about that.
Why does the professor say this?
So hydroponics is limited to developing regions, then?
33. Why does the professor suggest that the students refer to their lab workbook? 34. According to the professor, why are roots important to plants?
7. Library.
Listen to part of a conversation between a librarian and a student.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Are you the reference librarian?
Yes. How can I help you?
Well, I'm looking for a book that compares Great Britain, Australia, Canada, and the United States.
Okay. What exactly are you trying to compare?
I'm not quite sure. How about the cost of living?
Oh. Well, cost of living is, it's not very specific. I mean, what aspects of the cost of living do you need to find? Cost of living is a fairly broad topic.
It is?
Well, yes. Do you want this for personal information or is it for a class?
It's for my economics class.
Uh-huh.
With Professor Brooks.
Oh, okay. Well, do you just need numbers or is it a report, a narrative?
Just the numbers. I'm supposed to make a chart. It can be either a pie chart or a bar graph. And I have to have some demographic information, you know, in order to do the chart.
So you want a general comparison. I'm trying to imagine what you'll put on the graph.
Well, I'm not too clear about that. I was thinking I might make several graphs, you know, one for each country with the cost of basic things on it, and then I could compare the graphs.
Was that the assignment? Maybe if you could explain the assignment to me.
Okay. I have it right here, somewhere. Just a minute. Okay, here it is. It says, make a pie chart or a bar graph with at least 4 parts. It should be large enough to share with the class.
That's it?
Uh-huh. But it's for an economics class, and we have to be able to explain it to everyone. So that's why I was going for the cost of living, and my major's international business, so I was interested in comparing several countries.
But the professor really only asked you for 1 chart.
I guess so. But I'm trying to figure out how to compare those countries on 1 chart, and it's not that easy.
Okay. Well,
you think I should just do the 1 chart then?
It's usually better to follow the instructions for an assignment, unless you...
Oh, even if it's more than the professor asked for?
It's usually better to check with the professor first if you want to change the assignment.
Okay, then. I guess I need to choose 1 country and compare several factors for the 1 country.
Or, if you want to compare several countries, you probably need to zero in on 1 factor.
Yeah.
Like the average income for a family of 4, or...
Oh, I see. maybe I could compare the cost of a home.
Right.
So I could find that in an encyclopedia then.
Well, maybe. But you want current data, and I'm not sure that you'd find demographics on income and home prices in an encyclopedia. Anyway, look, why don't I show you where you can find some reference materials in economics? Then you can browse for a while. Maybe you'll find something that sparks an idea. But if you don't, then just come back to my desk and I'll look with you.
Thanks. That's great.
35. Why does the man approach the librarian? 36. Listen again to part of the conversation and then answer the following question.
It says, make a pie chart or a bar graph with at least 4 parts. It should be large enough to share with the class.
That's it?
Uh-huh.
What does the woman mean when she says this?
That's it?
37. What does the librarian imply? 38. What example does the librarian give for the assignment? 39. What will the man do with the information?